Hello and welcome to Living Downstream. I'm Julie Lowe, the Environmental and Education Outreach Leader through United Communities AmeriCorps and one of the hosts of Living Downstream. Today, our topic is the wild horses and burros of Oregon. And I'm delighted to be speaking with Teresa Barber, who goes by Val, and Janelle Giorso of the Oregon Wild Horse Organization. Welcome, ladies. Can you tell us more about yourself?
Thank you so much for having us. We actually are a national nonprofit, so we do advocate for all wild horses and burros across the country, although we have the most volunteers in the state of Oregon and the most boots on the ground in Oregon. But we are in legal administrative appeals across the country and have 8 current cases going on right now, most of them just waiting for the Interior Board of Land Appeals to actually make a decision.
Wow. So, and these are cases of animals in Oregon?
No, they're all across the country. Okay, we have them in Utah, New Mexico, Idaho, Nevada, and Oregon right now.
All righty. Tell me more about the wild horse population in Oregon. And I didn't realize we had burros and wild burros.
We have very few wild burros left. I'm honestly not sure how many are in the state of Oregon because they, to my knowledge, only existed in the Warm Springs HMA, which is not the Warm Springs Reservation, totally okay. Different area of Oregon. But they gathered them all in 2018, and I'm not sure how many may have slipped by those gathers. Burros are pretty good at escaping helicopter gathers.
Yeah,
because they just scatter everywhere. They don't follow the leader like horses do. So I'm not sure how many we might still have left in Oregon. Right now, it's nearly impossible to get an accurate count of how many horses are actually on the land. Part of the problem is that BLM tends to put out the population that they say is out there by doing a lot of computer modeling and guesstimating. They are supposed to do flyovers. When they do those aerial surveys, they add on a percentage because the National Academy of Sciences in 2013, when they did a review of the program, said that those surveys were probably undercounts because horses hide or move and you don't necessarily get them all.
Right.
So they just routinely add that percentage. When they do the computer modeling, they take a base number for a certain year, and then they add a certain percentage for every year after that because, again, NAS agreed with the BLM who said that horses populate a certain percentage every year. So that's just an automatic add-on, and it's anywhere from 15 to 25%, depending on the herd and the person at BLM that actually wrote whatever statement it is. The numbers tend to not be accurate. Well, so
what are we thinking?
Okay, so BLM's claiming there's over 80,000 on the land right now. We think it's closer to 60,000.
Okay.
Looking at the numbers that have been removed over the last few years and looking at the number that the herd has actually, or that the individual herds have actually increased in population based on previous statements by BLM, you have to go herd by herd and say, okay, this is what their population statistics show, that this herd is growing at a rate of about 12%. The thing that BLM never takes into account is that they've had this huge push for a few years to dart all these horses with a fertility control product called Gonicon.
Oh, okay.
Gonicon is really controversial right now. Just like there is another product that was called PZP. That's what was used to manage the horses out on Assateague Island on the East Coast.
Right.
Works really well. It's been in play for over 40 years. BLM fights and fights and fights about using it. They say, oh, these areas are so much bigger. It's too hard to get to the horses. The horses are not acclimated to people like the Assateague horses are. They make all kinds of excuses, basically. And really, if they're going to fly helicopters, they could dart the horses from helicopters. They could bait trap and do a band at a time. There's lots of ways it can be done. You can use volunteers to get out there and do it. And most of our herd areas now are not bigger than Assateague. So there's no excuse for not doing it, except PZP would not sterilize the horses unless it was used for a number of years consecutively. Whereas gonicon, if you give a mare 2 doses of gonicon, the chances of that mare being permanently sterile is significant.
Okay.
A mare or a stallion given gonicon, first time he's injected with it, would be sterile. So it's a dangerous product. And we've been after not only BLM, but also the EPA, because they refuse to give us the studies that were submitted to get that product registered with the EPA. And we sat with a FOIA for over a year waiting for it. We've now resubmitted that FOIA and done so working with a FOIA attorney to have the wording appropriate so that they can't find an excuse not to give us those documents. Mm-hmm. We also watched an interview with the man who did the only wild horse study of gonicon. And what he's saying about gonicon is not what BLM's saying. They use his earlier papers, but not the ones done once the project was finished, once the study was finished. He had actually asked at the end of the study to continue it because most of the mares didn't come back to fertility in the 11 years that that study went on. So he wanted to finish it out and follow those mares and see if they ever came back to fertility so that he could prove yes or no, this is a sterilant. Mm-hmm. BLM denied him continuing that study. And now they'll only use the earlier papers that don't show how many of those mares remained infertile. So they're hiding the fact that this is causing permanent sterility, but yet that's the one product that they're rushing to do 10-year plans to be able to give this product to all of our wild horses. When I say 10-year plans, typically BLM would only put a plan out when they're going to gather the horses and, you know, it was that one time thing. Well, now they're putting together these 10-year plans that say anytime the horses are over their set population level, they're going to go out there, gather them up and apply this product to any of the mares. So their plan is keep them at this low AML, which is their appropriate management level, their name for population. They want to keep them at that low level for the whole 10 years and make sure they just keep darting and darting and darting, or actually hand injecting these mares with it.
To extinction. Yeah. That will lead to their extinction eventually.
Because you're going to have nothing but sterile populations out there.
Well, let's back up for our listeners that aren't even familiar with the issue. Can you tell me about the history of the horse in Oregon? Are they native? When were they here? What is the issue? We consider the Wild West to the land of where the horses and the bison roam. What is the issue with wild horses? How long have they been here? Are they native?
It depends on who you ask.
Okay.
If you ask the federal government, they claim that the horses went extinct on this continent for a period of anywhere from 10 to 12,000 years, I think is what they say. Mm-hmm. Now, there's a couple of scientists in the country who are doing mitochondrial DNA studies on fossils. Mm-hmm. And the timeline that they can't prove the horses were still here is 5,700 years. And that would be Dr. Ross McPhee, and then Tyler Murchie. What's the native woman's name, Janelle?
Mm-hmm. Yvette Running Bear.
Well, there is another person. She's also a doctorate. But they're working on a lot of these fossil finds. And I know they had DNA from some of the horses here in Oregon that we really felt would prove that link from the horses that were here at the end of the Pleistocene epoch
right
to the horses today. And it's already been proven that they're the same species. You know, horses evolved on the North American continent for 56 million years.
Right.
And during that time, they went through a lot of different changes. So there were a lot of different genus and species of horse. And I'm not a scientist, so if I get my terms wrong, don't crucify me.
Right.
But basically, the last horse that was surviving at the end of the Pleistocene is our modern horse of today. So okay. What BLM likes to say is they went extinct. The horses that are out there today are just horses that escaped from the ranches, right? So they try to make it sound like these are domestic animals. And now the National Park Service is trying to say that they're actually livestock. Well, it's not true. If you look at the law, number one, Congress called them wild, not feral animals. So they're saying they are wildlife. They're not escaped ranch horses. They're wildlife. And that's a legal designation. When you get into native versus invasive, right, that's a scientific designation. And there's a lot of dispute over that. But if you talk to the tribes and get the oral histories and what their beliefs are, a lot of them kind of laugh when I say, do you believe horses are native? They're like, yeah. Right. They don't even understand why I'm asking them the question.
Yeah, that's Yvette. That was Yvette Running Horse Collins.
Thank you. So there's a big debate over whether or not the horses are native animals. And I believe that the government will fight us every step of the way in trying to get them actually designated as native animals, because when you have a native wildlife species, they're afforded more protection.
Yes, they are. Yeah.
So I think that's the big fight that we have ahead of us in proving this. But the science is there. The oral histories are there. You know, there's so much proof out there that these horses existed. And when you talk about specifically Oregon, one of the things that I found absolutely fascinating is if you go to the University of Oregon in Eugene and you go to the Natural History Museum, you see all the fossil finds, and they all talk about the location of the fossil when it was found.
Right.
They're all Eastern Oregon, most of them in the John Day area. Guess where all of Oregon's wild horses are today? Same area, Eastern Oregon, Lawton John Day area. You know, how likely is it that all these horses went extinct, were reintroduced by Spanish conquistadors, which is the government's theory, and then found their way back to the exact same spots where we're finding those fossils? I don't buy it. I don't believe they were ever gone.
So what is the issue with the horses then? What is the problem? Why is this a management problem for BLM or anyone?
They eat grass. And if you look at the moneyed interests on the land, cows eat grass.
So are we competing with other wildlife, or are we competing with domestic stock?
We're competing with domestic animals, with livestock, cows and sheep mostly.
There are 30 to 35 million deer in the U.S.
Yeah.
And then you have elk. They aren't screaming that they're all overpopulated, but 60,000-80,000 wild horses is overpopulated, according to the BLM. There's around a million elk.
That's why I'm wondering who's competing. Like the elk and the deer, of course, go where they want. I am assuming the cattle and the sheep are controlled in where they can go. So where does the horse fall? So talk to me about that.
Well, elk and sheep are not always controlled. They are free range out there. Sometimes they're fenced into an area, but not always. So it just depends. You know, we've had the climate crisis. We've had severe droughts. If you go out there, there's not much food. There's not much water in some areas. So they're faced with decreasing the permit numbers for livestock. And livestock, you know, producers don't like that. It's cutting into their profits. So their solution is, well, get rid of those horses. We'll have more grass and water.
Okay,
the other major issue is that livestock are damaging our public lands. They're in bad shape. They are so overgrazed everywhere that there's livestock. And instead of the government claiming that damage and owning up to the fact that they have permitted too many livestock out there for too long, they blame the damage on the horses. And like Janelle just told you, the population numbers are astronomical. There are 30 cows for every one horse on our public lands. How can you possibly make the claim that it's a horse doing the damage? It's such irresponsible management. And the other thing is, you know, BLM is now mandated to take into consideration what the impacts are to the current climate crisis for every decision that they make. That's an executive order. And they're not doing it. What they do when they put out a Wild Horse and Burro Gather plan, they will now tell us usually what the allotment is for livestock to be there, but they don't allow us to say, look, if you remove the livestock, we believe that the land would heal and the horses could be there, and you don't have to waste money doing a helicopter gather and money to warehouse and feed and vet these horses and burros.
Mm-hmm.
And they come back and tell us that any discussion of livestock is outside the scope of their plan. So they won't even discuss it with us.
Mm.
So it's just a closed topic. And what we found was looking at the rangeland health assessments, especially for cattle and sheep permit areas, they aren't doing them. There are so few done, and they're required to do them every 10 years. They're just not doing them. You know, we are not also seeing those rangeland health assessments on wild horse and burro areas because they haven't been done. Mm-hmm. And when they do send something that they'll call an assessment, it's somebody's handwritten notes that may not even be qualified to do it. They don't put the person's qualifications on there. We don't know who it is. It's some BLM employee that says they've done an assessment because they drove out there and took some pictures. That's not good enough. It doesn't cut it. We want real assessments done.
So if someone was to do the assessment or assessments in the past that have been done, what is the wild horse impact on the environment and the ecosystem? And how do they interact with, let's say, the wild animals? Let's keep the cattle out for a minute, considering the horse is a wild animal. How do they work with their ecosystem?
They're fantastic with the ecosystem. Horses contribute to the biodiversity on the land. They're seed dispersers. They're not ruminants like cows and sheep and even elk and deer are all ruminants, right? So when they eat something, they destroy the seeds. They don't redispense them, you know, as they defecate. Whereas horses do. Horses actually have a very poor digestive system.
Okay.
So things tend to come right back out unprocessed.
Okay.
And then it's in this perfect little package of fertilizer and a seed.
Right.
So they're actually very good, and they're good for water retention in the soil. Horses also act as a carbon sink. So they're really important for the land. And on top of that, they also eat that dried grass that's out there.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, our lands right now are completely invaded out in the West by things like cheatgrass and crested wheat that were first introduced by the livestock industry out there. And it grows really, really fast, and it has a fast life cycle. So mm-hmm. you'll see it green, it dies, it seeds, it comes back, you know, and it's very quick. So ranchers like that because you constantly got some new grass growing in. But when it dies, it's all brown. Cows don't eat it at that point. And it acts as a carpet of dry material. So when we get these wildfires, it takes off on cheatgrass. Whereas if you have our native bunch grasses, you have a plant here and there's some soil around it, that there's a plant here. So it takes a lot longer for a wildfire to be able to spread in those areas than it does in area of cheatgrass. So having the horses out there to eat more of this dry brush and the dry grasses is so beneficial for us right now. And it'll help us, you know, decrease the level of wildfire. So we need the horses out there. As far as other wildlife species go, horses have no issue with other wildlife species. That's a claim that BLM is making now. We debunked that in one of their claims. We actually have a paper on our website. It's a rebuttal. BLM had one paragraph. They used four different studies to try to claim that wild horses cause time partitioning between species, which means that if a wild horse band is at a water hole and a group of other animals are going to come in, they may not come in while the horses are there. That causes time partitioning. Well, that happens in all wildlife species. And they cause this time partitioning that is how they coexist together in nature. And honestly, what they're saying about the horses in the water hole and deer and elk and pronghorn coming to water is not true. We have pictures that prove it's not true. Mm-hmm. You know, will a horse ever get aggressive with one of those animals if it gets too close to their babies? Yeah, of course it will.
Sure.
You know, every mom protects her babies. So, you know, there are individual incidences, but overall, it's not a generalized problem like BLM is claiming it is. It's absolutely a lie.
They also don't urinate and defecate in the water like cows do.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. Horses won't. They'll leave the water. They will go next to a water source. So can it still leach into the water? Yeah. But they won't stand there in the water. And they also don't hang out at water sources. Cattle will hang out at a water source all day. Horses don't do that. They come in, they get their drink, and they leave. And the reason for that is they're a very highly sensitive prey species.
Right.
And they know intuitively, I'm at a water source. This is where predators are going to watch for me.
Right.
So they come in and, you know, you'll see a horse or two that actually watches while everybody takes turns getting their drink. And, you know, sometimes they'll roll in the water, take a bath, and sometimes they'll play in the water. But it's usually a pretty serious business of, okay, get the water you need and let's get out of here before one of us gets hurt. So cows don't do that. They'll hang out there all day. And horses will travel up to 20 miles a day to go from food to water and things like that. So they move a lot.
All right. So it sounds like they're easier on the riparian zone.
Oh, yeah.
That and the soil, they don't have cloven hooves. You know, their hooves do not do the damage that, like, the plow-like hooves of cattle and sheep.
And even elk and deer. They have cloven hooves. You know, so they have, like, I don't know, do deer? I don't think deer do. But they have toes. The animals that have cloven hooves that look like toes actually act like shovels because it doesn't disperse their weight on a solid hoof. So when it acts like a little shovel, when they step down, they actually push into the stream banks and stuff. So they do more damage than a horse will to stream banks as far as hoof damage goes.
Okay. And I heard maybe the opposite, that the cloven hoof separates the weight more than the horse's single toe.
Yeah, no. I could send you some scientific studies on that one.
Okay. And then you had also mentioned something about carbon storage with horses. What's that about?
I'm not a scientist. I'll send you a paper.
Okay.
Unless Janelle can get there with it.
Well, it has to do with the moisture and the topsoil that they contribute to.
That it holds the carbon in the soil?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Tell me something about the behavior and social dynamics of wild horses.
They're just cool.
Herd. Tell me about it. This is something I want to go see.
Initially, we had this big national herd. And, you know, the number of animals that were in our national herd at the beginning of the 1900s was over 1 million horses. Some people say 2 million. So there were a lot of them out there in the wild, and they coexisted with everybody. And after that, we had the Mustangers that would get out and round up horses, and they were not necessarily gentle with these horses, and they would shoot them and sell them for meat and all kinds of horrible stuff. And that's when a woman named Velma Johnson, which people know as Wild Horse Annie, started going to Congress and really fighting for them. And ultimately, it brought about the 1971 Wild Free Roaming Horses and Burros Act.
Uh-huh.
After that happened, BLM had to make a list of all the places the horses were in 1971 on our public lands.
Okay.
And those areas were supposed to be managed principally for wild horses and burros. And what happened was as they drew the maps for where those horse herds were, then all of a sudden they became separate herds. It was no longer just our wild horses. It was this herd and that herd and this herd. And they're usually named for what their herd management area is called. Mm-hmm. You know, like here in Oregon, you know, we have the Steens Mountain herd, which is one of the most popular. And then there's also the Kiger horses, which are on two different herd management areas. But breeders really like those horses. So when they split this up into different herds, the areas kind of started getting smaller. Mm-hmm. And as that happened, there were less and less interaction between herds. So you do still have herds in a herd management area. And within the herd, you'll have smaller bands. The bands don't interact with each other much. Sometimes they'll run into each other, but usually it ends up in a lead stallion, you know, arguing with another lead stallion, because each band has a lead stallion, sometimes a lieutenant, or some younger stallions. Once they get older, the lead stallion will usually chase them out and go, okay, you're out of here. You're not breeding my mares.
Right.
So he has what's called a harem, which are all his mares. Uh-huh. And then the young and maybe another adult or two stallion. And the younger stallions that get driven off usually live in what we call bachelor bands. And they'll grow up together and spar and fight and do what horses do. And then once they feel like, you know, they're ready, they'll go and try to sneak off with a lead stallion's mare or fight the stallion to try to take over the herd. And so it's interesting to watch the dynamics. And there's usually a lead mare in those bands as well. It's just really cool to watch them. And I think my favorite experience with the wild horses was when I was following a band in the Ochocoos National Forest. And they're actually managed by Forest Service. Mm-hmm. And right now there's a massive lawsuit to try and save them from being wiped out. And that's from Central Oregon Wild Horse Coalition, which is one of our coalition partners.
Okay.
And that band, when I was following them, the lead stallion's name is Gelato. And he stayed between me and his band, and I followed them for hours. Uh-huh. And the herd would stop, he would stop, and he'd turn and look at me to make sure I had stopped too. And I'm like, all right, buddy, I get it. I'm waiting here. And then we'd all move on. And when he was done with me following them, he kind of nickered at his mares and told them, get going. And they ran across this little stream down this little gully away, and he stood there and he turned around and he pinned his ears back and pawed at the ground. And I thought, okay, is he going to run at me or is he just telling me? And he just kind of had this really deep guttural noise he made at me. And I went, okay, I get it. And I took a couple steps backward and he turned around and ran off. That was
neat. Yeah.
So it was just that body language that's like, okay, I know you're all right, so you can follow us for a while. And then later it was, all right, we're done with you now. Go home. So it's just really cool.
Yeah.
Now, what's your favorite?
When I was a kid, we'd camp out at the Steens Mountains or Heart Mountain, and we were driving down the road. We're in the back of the pickup. Me and my two sisters are in the back of the pickup getting all sunburned. And we look over and there was three or four wild horses over there in the middle of nowhere. It was so awesome. And they just stood there. They were probably 300 yards out from where we were. And I wish that they had cell phones and I would have taken pictures.
Oh, right. Yeah.
It was the most awesome thing. And then that was back when the band America had the song Horses No Name.
Oh, yes.
That was my favorite song. And I always thought of those horses every time I heard it. I saw them a couple times out there. And that was in the 60s. And that's basically the last time I was able to see any out there.
Well, that makes me wonder, what role did the wild horses play in the cultural heritage and the history of Oregon, you know, especially with indigenous communities?
Reaching the indigenous communities in Oregon is a little bit harder than a lot of places. I'm not sure why. I'm not a native Oregonian. I grew up in upstate New York, but lived a lot of other places in my lifetime on the East Coast. So being here in Oregon, I've been here for about a decade now. Being here in Oregon was kind of a culture shock for me. Things are very different here than they were on the East Coast. I've done animal advocacy my entire life. I did a domestic horse rescue for a lot of years. I'm disabled now, so as my disability got worse and I gave up the physical parts of things, I started working on the legal advocacy for wild horses and burros. And trying to communicate with the tribes here, they don't trust you. You're mm-hmm. seen as an outsider. So it's right. very hard. I did talk to someone recently who's from the Warm Springs tribe. And she said she was one of those people who looked at me like I was just crazy when I asked her if they felt they were native.
Oh, you know, sure.
She gave me the strangest look. She goes, of course they are. And the other thing I've started talking to some of the tribes about is what their own oral histories are of when these horses came, and did they get them from white man, or, right. you know, did they have them before? And the general consensus is they had them before they ever saw a white man. So is it possible that they came through the southern border with right. conquistadors and right, then right. moved their way north before Indians ever saw a white man? That's possible. And by the way, just for the record, I am Oneida. So I'm not an enrolled member. I'm looking mm-hmm. into trying to do that. But I have some roots that are there.
Yeah.
And uh-huh. I've been trying to make a lot of connections. And like today, we sent off a letter to Director Stone Manning about the horse. We had 45 different tribes in the United States that had members that signed on to that letter.
Oh, nice. Uh-huh.
45. That's astronomical. We had people from all 50 states, from 45 different tribes, from 40 other countries, and 3 tribes outside the U.S. that signed on to that letter. The support that these horses have is huge. And I don't know why not only BLM, but Congress doesn't get that. Seems like an issue of money is more important than what anybody thinks. And the livestock industry is huge with very deep pockets.
Campaign money.
What would be the answer for these horses? What would you be advocating for them to remain wild? Or alternatively, I mean, are these animals that are available? The layman, I would assume, thinks all horses are domestic animals. You know, it's just how we were raised, that they were mm-hmm. a domestic animal. Is that an option for these horses to be basically adopted? But that seems kind of sad if their wild animal be taken out of their environment.
One of the big issues, like BLM has their adoption program.
Uh-huh.
People can adopt a horse from one of their adoption events, and then technically the government still owns them for a year until that person is given the title.
Oh,
and mm-hmm. allegedly BLM will check on these horses to make sure everything's okay before they give the title.
Not true.
Yeah. I don't know of anybody that's ever had somebody knock on their door and check on their adopted horses.
They didn't know.
Yeah, and they didn't on yours. And you have how many, Janelle?
I have 5 of the wild horses and one burro. I had adopted 2 burros. Mountain Lion got one of them.
So, and my introduction to wild horses was in trying to get the BLM to come check on horses, because a couple that I sold a horse to starved her. And I could not see the other horses in their barn. They had no pasture, no windows, couldn't see them. But found out they had adopted horses from an event at Cornell University. And so I called BLM and begged them to come out and check on those horses, and they refused to do it. Their excuse was, we only have 1 compliance officer for 31 states east of the Mississippi.
Wow.
So they refused to come check those horses. I was furious. That's what got me into wild horses in the first place, because I saw that these horses were doomed when they got adopted. The other huge issue is they have all these online adoption events and things mm-hmm. like that. And people go and it's like, oh, look at that beautiful wild yeah. horse. I'm adopting it. They get it home and they go, oh my God, that's a wild freaking horse. And they have no idea what to do with it.
Right.
They don't know how to train them. So it's a bad situation for them. Plus, when they round them up to take them off the range, like I told you, these horses have familial connections with each other. And horses are extremely sensitive animals. So you're getting an animal that has been rounded up by being terrified by a helicopter most of the time. It has been transported, separated from its family, forced into a squeeze chute so they can give it a bunch of shots and all that stuff. It has zero trust in humans. Mm-hmm. It has learned to fear humans, and then you throw it in an adoptive home with somebody who may not know anything about dealing with a wild animal. I mean, it's a situation that more often than not ends up with that person getting their title after 1 year, which means the horse no longer has federal protections. It becomes their property, which means they can do whatever they want with it, and they ship them to the sale yard. They end up in slaughter pens, and we're seeing that all over the place.
The sales authority horses, if they're over 10 years old or have been offered for adoption 3 times, they are just sold to anybody. The kill buyers can come in with and get a truckload and go straight over the border to slaughter.
Yeah. Theoretically, BLM's not allowed to sell to someone they know is going to ship them to slaughter. Theoretically, they sign an agreement that says, I don't intend to take these horses to slaughter. But it happens all the time.
And they don't enforce.
I mean, it's not enforceable because in the United States, you can do what you want with your property as long as you're not, you know, abusing or neglecting or whatever, if it's an animal. But you can take that animal and sell it. It's your property. So it's not enforceable to say we're going to prosecute you if you sign this document saying you don't intend to ship it to slaughter and you do it anyway, because we can't prove your intent was that the day you signed it. So we have no say anymore. It's not enforceable. That's why Tom Davies didn't get in trouble when he took over 100 horses. It was 180 horses or something from the kill pen to slaughter.
It was 1,700. It was Tom Davies. The BLM is so anxious to empty the pen so they could add more as they pull them off the range that they're paying adopters $1,000 per horse if they adopt them, which is a bad idea. You've got people that, I can grab 4 horses. The whole family, we'll get them all involved. We'll each grab 4 horses. We'll
four
put them out
max.
To pasture, and then we'll round them up and haul them down to the kill pen and sell them for meat. So they got the $1,000 each for them, plus what they make selling them for meat. It's disgusting.
AIP stands for Adoption Incentive Program.
Okay.
And there have been calls to end that for a couple years now because, people are just taking the horses, waiting the year till they get title, and then shipping them to slaughter. And they're making, you can get up to 4 horses each individual. Wow. And we have proof of families of 4 and 5 people who all get 4 horses each. That's pretty good income for a year, I'd say.
Then they go adopt more because BLM doesn't take them off their adoption list.
Right.
Potential adopters.
Okay, so you're definitely against the adoption of horses. They're not appropriate for it usually.
Yeah, I don't think the only way a wild horse is safe is to stay on the land. You had asked, okay, so what do we see as the answer, right?
Right.
Because obviously you've got wild horses and they are going to breed. And we agree that they probably increase their population by 12 or 15% a year. Some herds, maybe more. And we agree with BLM that there are not enough predators to control them. Okay. BLM says they don't have natural predators. That's not true. They have wolves, mountain lions, bears, and even sometimes coyotes.
Coyotes, yeah.
They kill the babies.
And yeah, they'll definitely kill the babies or a sick or old horse or whatever. And coyotes are starting to hunt in packs. So they will take down a full-size horse if it's isolated. And they definitely prey on the burros. That's one of their favorite meals for a mountain lion is burros. What we would love to see is a reintroduction of those predator species. But again, who are you fighting on that? The livestock industry.
Mm-hmm.
They don't want them out there. And then, of course, you deal with hunters who also don't like them out there because they want to hunt the same prey. There is another solution, which is to use PZP. And BLM, when they've used PZP, they tend to set it up so that it doesn't succeed. And what I mean by that is they'll say, well, we're using PZP on this herd and it hasn't worked. Well, if you look at their records, they don't dart enough mares with it to make it work. You know, they'll dart 10 mares in a whole herd of 800 horses. Well, that's not going to work. They set it up to fail. And the reason for that, again, is because they really wanted to use something that would sterilize these horses so that it's just done. They don't have to deal with them anymore.
Roundup speed the ranchers too, because they ultimately own the holding pens and taxpayers pay to care for the horses long term.
And a lot of times it's the ranchers who are actually the contractors doing the helicopter gathers as well. So
yes,
they're really making a lot of money off of removing horses. They get to do the helicopter gather. They hire the wranglers. They are the ones that a lot of times are transporting and housing the horses in these long-term leased pastures. BLM will lease a pasture area and it'll have hundreds of horses on it. What bothers me a whole lot about those things is that because they're private property, the public has no access. So there's no real oversight of those long-term leased pastures. The horses are still technically owned by we the people, right? BLM manages them just like they manage our public lands for us. They're held in trust. So if they're in a long-term pasture and that's where they're going to live out their lives, we should have the right to be able to see them and know that they're really there. Mm-hmm. Because a lot of times people who have gained access find out that the horses that they claim are there, that they're getting paid per head for, aren't there. Where did they go? Were they shipped to slaughter? What happened to them? Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of corruption, a lot of lack of transparency there. Even the legal system for the horses is so biased. You cannot get a win. You cannot. Some of our most recent cases are absolutely ridiculous statements that we're getting from the appeals board. I don't know if you know anything about the appeals process, but...
Not particularly, no.
When BLM makes a decision to go out and gather horse, they write up what's called an environmental assessment. And this is done for other things too, but we deal with environmental assessments. We never get an environmental impact statement, which was a much bigger, much more in-depth document that assesses the land and the impacts of their decision. We never get those. We get an environmental assessment and they come out and they say, nope, we don't need to do an impact statement. Once they put a decision out about that, you know, we get to comment on it and BLM gets to say, yeah, we heard you. We're doing it anyway. They don't listen to what we say. They don't respond to what we say. They don't interact with what we say. They do what they want. Getting our public comments is just a procedural step that they're mandated to take, but they don't respond to them. We put in substantive public comments and they give us junk responses like that's opinion, or we discussed this on page 45 of the EA. Well, we know that's what we were responding to. So those are the kind of responses we get. So once they put the decision out and they say, okay, you responded, we're going to do it anyway, then we can file what's called an administrative appeal. That's done by sending this appeal to the Interior Board for Land Appeals. And they're also a department under the Department of Interior, just like BLM. So it's all in-house. And the IBLA is run by a panel of judges appointed by the Secretary of the DOI, Deb Holland, in this year. And those judges are supposed to be impartial. That's the reason that the IBLA was created in 1970. And that's because these appeals were being heard by the Department of Interior Solicitor's Office. And people were complaining that it wasn't impartial. So they created the IBLA. Now, when Congress created them, obviously they said, okay, you're judges, you have to hear this impartially and make decisions on these. We send our appeals there, and we've got cases as old as 6 years that they've not made a decision on. The only time that they make a decision quickly is if we file our appeal with what's called a petition to stay. In other words, we want to stop that action while you hear this appeal. Well, they always deny those, but they have to respond to those within a certain number of days. That's in the law. But there is no time that they have to respond to the actual case itself in. So we've got several cases sitting there, two of them 6 years old. And right now, I think we have 8 cases. The 2 that we still have open have just been the most ridiculous things I have ever dealt with in my life. And I have been doing these appeals for 10 years. We have one that's here in Oregon for Palomino Buttes, which is a herd management area very close to Burns, Oregon. In that appeal, the BLM didn't notify us of the public comment period. I found it 2 weeks into the 30-day comment period. Asked for an extension since they hadn't notified us. BLM refused to do that. So that was a legal violation, number one. After that, they made their decision and we were writing our appeal. And during the 30 days we had to file that appeal, BLM went and did the gather. They didn't wait for us to even file an appeal. And there's opposing federal regulation about that, because the IBLA's regulations say that BLM can't implement a decision during the time that a party who may be adversely affected has to appeal the decision. But BLM got another regulation passed that said, well, despite that, if it's a wild horse and burro gather, you can do it as soon as you put out the decision. So the two regulations don't even match up. I knew of the horse regulation, but I assumed that that was for use during an emergency. If you had a fire or horses that were standing in the highway or really destroying somebody's private property, that would be an emergency situation where they didn't have to wait for us to file an appeal, right? That would be ridiculous. I gathered that was why that was created, but BLM's now using it to avoid us even trying to file a stay for a decision. And the IBLA is allowing it thus far. And the other thing is the bar to achieve a stay, you have to prove something called irreparable harm, right? In one of our recent cases from Idaho, we warned when we filed that stay that if they went ahead with the plan, there were foals that were so young, we were really worried they weren't going to be able to survive a helicopter gather. While BLM admitted one foal died, we believe there were more, but they admitted one foal died during that gather. Now, they started the gather after we filed the stay and before the board even ruled on it. And their justification was, well, they didn't award the stay. I said, they didn't deny it yet either, but they allowed them to do the stay. And the board basically said, when we replied to that situation and we said, look, we warned you that foals were going to die. We know at least one is dead. Here's the frame by frame video of our person got out there. And we believe there were at least three foals that died. The IBLA came back with a decision about it saying, it's okay that they did the gather. We were going to deny your petition to stay anyway. And an irreparable or a dead horse does not constitute irreparable harm.
Oh, I see.
If that's not irreparable harm, I don't know what is. Never been able to achieve that bar. Every time they set it and we get up there, they move it again. I don't think I know of any wild horse organization that's ever achieved a stay in an appeal. Even though we point out they broke this law, they didn't follow this law, they broke the Administrative Procedures Act here. We've got questions about Gonacon and the fact that it can sterilize, and here's the science on it. They ignore all of it and go, nope, they can go ahead. We'll decide this whenever we feel like it. Well, I hate to say this, but if it takes them another 6 years where they're using Gonacon on all these herds, they're going to be sterile before the board ever decides anything.
And so we'll have an extinct species, basically.
And I think they think it's okay because there's horses over there in that person's pasture. So what's the big deal, right? Well, the big deal is we still have herds that have very primitive traits. And you can
tell me about those.
Yeah, when you look at some of those horses, now BLM calls them Spanish markers when they do the DNA. I don't believe they're Spanish. I believe that's our Native American wild horse primitive trait, right? But those horses tend to be what's called a dun color, which is kind of a beige. And they have this black dorsal stripe that goes along their spine. And a lot of times they have leg bars, black bars on their legs like zebras.
Right.
And they'll have a shorter, more squared head and thicker neck. And most of the time, more muscling on the front of their chest because they're moving constantly. And they're a lot of times up and down these mountains. What BLM's tending to do when they gather a herd, those horses come out for adoption. The horses they leave in there are ones that have DNA that is more domestic breeds. So they'll have quarter horse or whatever. And those are breeds that were developed. It's not a different species. So it doesn't really matter what the genetic traits or markers are of these horses. But we do still have some that are very primitive looking. And those are the ones that I really want them to protect. We even have horses that have curly hair. Did you know that?
Oh, no, that's neat.
Yeah, they're curly coated. And those are so rare, and they round those up and remove them too. There is no protection for these primitive traits in these horses. The only ones that they've really protected are the sulfur herd, and then there's the Kiger horses, and they're on two HMAs that BLM created. Those horses came out of the Beatty's Butte herd here in Oregon, and they found this whole group of horses that had these really high, what they call Spanish markers. They all had the similar physical traits. So they took those horses and they created two HMAs for those horse, Tiger and Riddle HMAs. Now, mind you, if you talk to BLM about putting horses here or there because of wildfire protection, mm-hmm. they go, oh, we can't put horses where they weren't in 1971. Which is what the law says. But yet they created these two HMAs for these horses. The reason they did it is because there was a group of breeders who set up a breed registration for Kiger horses. About every 4 to 5 years, they gather those horses and they have a big auction and sell them off to the highest bidder. They do not castrate those stallions, although they do every other stallion that gets adopted. Because the breeders will pay really big money. The first year I was here in Oregon, one Kiger stallion went for $30,000.
Wow.
You can go to the holding pen and pick up a horse for $125.
Are these horses at all, I'm trying to think of other arguments people would want them off the land. Are they of any danger to people? Are there any human interactions with horses that are dangerous? Or are they a threat to anyone else except basically cattle and livestock people?
We have not ever heard of... I take that back. There was one instance where I heard that a bachelor band of stallions got aggressive with a human. Did the human get too close? Was it bachelors that were playing and sparring and dusting up, and the human thought, "Oh my God, they're after me." You mean we don't know? But no, they're not a danger. If anything, they'll run from you.
Yeah, they're prey species.
Yep, prey species. Highly intuitive.
They might go out in the road. That would be
collision.
People need to watch where they're going.
I think that's probably the biggest issue, actually, for public safety, is them getting in roads. And it's pretty simple. You've got volunteer organizations all over that would be willing to fund putting up a fence along a highway, would be willing to put the manpower hours into putting up a fence along the highway. I mean, there are ways to deal with situations like those. Put an overpass, an underpass, whatever. It's good for all wildlife, but they won't, because it gives them a reason to round them up.
Well, can people go out and see these horses? Where would their best chance to do so be?
In Oregon, it was Steens Mountain. There's a road called Steens Mountain Loop, but that's been out of commission for a while because they had rock slide. So I don't know if you can see the horses from one end or the other end. That would be something to call the Burns BLM office and ask whether or not you can see them from either end, so you know before you drive the whole way, because it is a long road. The other place in Oregon is the Ochocoos National Forest. That's called the Big Summit Herd. And again, they're managed by Forest Service. But if somebody really wanted to go see those horses, I would encourage them to contact Central Oregon Wild Horse Coalition, or they can contact us. And ours is real simple to remember. It's just Oregon Wild Horse Organization at gmail.com, or find us on the web.
And that's the way, of course, you're going to get people interested and to fall in love with them if they can see them.
You can also call our office when you're going to make a trip, and that's 541-315-6650, and people would get me, and I can hook you up with an appropriate guide. Like if you're in Arizona in the Apache Sitgreaves National Forest, we've got a contact. If you're in Nevada, New Mexico, we can find you guides that may know where to find the horses that time of year and help you find them out there.
Oh, cool.
There's becoming fewer and fewer numbers, so it's harder.
They're harder to find. Now, even people that go out and watch the horses all the time are telling us that they can't find them anymore. They've removed so many. Like when they did the Palomino Buttes gather, they said that there was, you know, this certain population and we're going to round up this many horses. They didn't even find that many to round up. If that tells you what a lie their population numbers are.
Yeah, it can't be 80,000, right?
Yeah, in a helicopter, they couldn't find the number of horses they wanted to gather from that herd management area. It's because they weren't there. They had just gathered them 2 years prior. The only reason they did gather them was so they could implement that 10-year plan to shoot them up with Gonacon. And the other thing about Gonacon, the difference between PZP and Gonacon that we were talking about, PZP can be darted remotely. Gonacon is less effective than PZP if they try to dart it, because it's a really thick liquid. So when they dart it, the horse doesn't get all of the product.
Right.
So they have to actually round them up and keep them in a pen and hand inject them. So it can't be done without a helicopter gather, which is the huge expense to the taxpayer, right?
Yeah.
Whereas if we can do remote injection, you can have darters out there that are volunteers. Mm-hmm. There are groups of volunteers that do a PZP darting. And, you know, we even have a situation in New Mexico where Wild Horse Observers Association, another one of our coalition partners, worked with the Forest Service to put a plan in place. It's called their WOW National Plan. And they put this forward. And what it does is actually pays ranchers to help manage the horses. And the ranchers do the darting and record keeping. And then there's some oversight of their record keeping because, you know, we have people who go, how dare you let ranchers touch these horses? Yeah. They hate the horses. Well, yeah. They're getting paid, and they're getting paid as much as they would to have cows on the land. Just to go manage the horses. So it worked out as a win-win. They still make their profits. We still have our horses. And they're being managed with a safe product that doesn't sterilize them.
Right.
So it is a workable situation. And it's all done without a helicopter gather. They do some water bait trapping of bands where it's real remote areas. And there's not a good place to kind of hide and wait for them to come in. So they'll do some bait trapping, and usually a band will come in and they'll get caught in a trap, and then they'll go out, dart them, and let them go. And it's still a lot cheaper than those helicopter gathers that end up with horses in holding. And when they do gonicon the first time for a herd, they have to do one dose and then another one 30 days later, which has never been studied, by the way. That 30-day darting schedule, been studied. They just did it. But they have to gather all the horses, and they gather the whole herd. They take them all to the holding pens, do all their shots and all that stuff. But the mares, they have to wait 30 days to give them that second injection.
The second one,
So we're warehousing every mare for 30 days, which also costs more. And then they have to transport them back out to public lands. So you're also putting these wild animals through two different transports. So it's horrible for the horses, when it could be done on the range.
Right.
And that's our big, big thing, is we want these horses managed on the range. So.
Alrighty. Well, you guys, thank you so much. This has been fantastic. This is so, I want to go out and see these guys next week. I'll give you a call and see where they might be. Let me remind our listeners, this has been an episode of Living Downstream, and I'm your host, Julie Lowe. I've been speaking with Teresa and Janelle of the Oregon Wild Horse Organization. If you dropped in late or missed any part of this interview or any other interview in our series, you could find past episodes at unclewatersheds.org. And thank you for listening.